Hey guys, it's me, Bonnie Somerville. Welcome back to Second Act. I hope everyone's doing great, managing this crazy time we're living in, but the end is near. Vaccines are coming. I feel it. I hope everyone's happy and healthy out there, and thank you for joining me and sticking with the podcast. And please don't forget, download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave me that good review. Like I said, any review, bad, whatever, just say something, preferably nice, so that I can keep doing this. And follow me on Instagram. The podcast is second_act_podcast. And I am Bonz with a Z, Somerville at Instagram. And don't forget to send me questions and messages. I'm collecting them. I've only gotten a few. Come on. I'm giving you like carte blanche. You guys can ask me whatever you want. I mean, I'm pretty ballsy. I'll probably answer them. But I want to have a segment where I answer questions. So please do that. And I'm very excited about my next guest. This is a very successful writer, director, producer, man who does it all. He's an artist. He's just pretty amazing. He's one of the most creative people I've ever known. And he was responsible, along with Darren Star, of giving me my very first pilot that went to series called Gross Point, which was on the WB 20 years ago, where I met Lindsay Sloan, who you guys heard me talk to, who's one of my favorite people on the planet. And his name is Andy Fleming. Andy Fleming. He is, he's directed a multitude of great movies like Dick, The Craft, Threesome, The In-Laws, tons of television shows. And he was just nominated for a Golden Globe for Emily in Paris, which you can watch on Netflix. So please enjoy this interview with my longtime friend, Andy Fleming. I'm very excited. I have a very especially special guest, an esteemed writer, director, producer, jack of all trades, cowboy, you name it, he does it all. He also gave me my very first break in my very first show that was, I'm still not over the cancellation of, none of us are, called Gross Point, which was on the WWWB, you kids, before there was CW. Andy Fleming, hi.
Hi, Bonnie. Remember Gross Point? That was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. I think we just realized that it was over. I'd like to stop at 20, but it was over 20. And I had Lindsay on a few podcasts ago.
I heard. I listened to every word.
She's the best. But it is true that I still go on auditions and casting directors still say, oh, Gross Point, that was my favorite show. Oh my God. And we still held on to this idea that there would be like some sort of a reboot, but no, alas.
No. Yeah, I know. I go to meetings and start talking about things. And if I mention Gross Point and it's a female executive, especially, they go, that was my favorite show. That show changed my life. I love that show. That show was ahead of its time. Everybody of a certain age remembers that show.
And it was ahead of its time. For you guys who don't know it, you could get it on Amazon. Dave actually watched a bunch and thought it was hysterical. It was an inside look at a spoof of 90210. So it was like kind of an inside show, but there hadn't been any of those shows yet. And it was adult content. And they put us on after Sabrina the Teenage Witch on Fridays. Like, I mean, it was
a bad time slot and it wasn't on the right network. And
it should have been on HBO.
Yeah. So that you could have sworn a blue streak.
But talk about Second Act, my famous story that I can retell, because this is the man responsible. Whenever people ask me, and I have talked about it with the person herself, Amy Adams was fired from Gross Point. I replaced her. That was my big break. And I've since met Amy many times because we have a mutual friend. And I always want to say, I wish I had your fucking career instead. So no, thanks, Andy, for giving me that break.
It doesn't work that way.
But so this whole show is about like Second Act and starting over. And now that I have the actual director and on the phone, on my podcast, like people always ask me like, but why, but how, but she's so amazing. And I always tell them like, sometimes that has nothing to do with it. Like sometimes it's just not the right fit. So like, what was it?
Yeah.
What was different about her, us?
It was, well, the thing is it was a surprise to me and to Darren. The network made the decision to fire her after the table read. which was on a Friday before the Monday when we were shooting. So it was very last minute. You came in on a Saturday, I think, to audition.
I came in on a Saturday, and I tell this story to young actors that I work with or I mentor, that I will never forget that, because I was 24 years old. It was my first pilot. I was absolutely sick to my stomach, nervous. My managers were like, listen, you might be able to get this, you know, blah, 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 blah. And you were, I was in the room with you and Darren and who else? Was it Robin? There was only three of you. And you worked with me to the point where it was like, I always thought it was going to be like that. I always thought directors were going to be like, work with you, work with you, work with, do you remember that? You were like, and then you said to me, you pulled me aside outside and you were like, listen, I want you to get this job. I know what they want. Trust me. Do you remember saying that?
Sounds like me. But yeah, no, it's a crazy thing auditioning for a pilot. And I try to be honest with the actors and give them the information that will help them. Mm-hmm. Because I want them all to be as good as possible. But yeah, I do remember when you came in that we were like, she's really good. Let's get her to read well. She, you know what I mean? It was like, it wasn't like you had the part, but we wanted you all to be good and get the part, you know.
But I was so green. I'd only done one movie and a three lines on Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza Place and two lines on 90210. And I was a nervous wreck, but I just remember you kept saying, no, do it like in a great way. And it was like, I got more comfortable, more comfortable, more comfortable. We worked it. And then my manager called me and she said, you need to go to the hair salon tomorrow at 4 a.m. On Monday, because your call time is 6 a.m. and you need to go at 4 a.m. Oh no, I think it was 3:45 and get your hair dyed. So I went and got my hair dyed, showed up on set. It was like the best day of my life, but I was so petrified because the cast all knew each other.
You were so put together. You were always like, you were hitting your mark and saying your lines and nailing it. It was so, no. And the whole, all of the cast were quite young. But you were spot on.
But when, like, for people listening, because they asked me about how it's been for me to get fired and what it's like. And it's like, that's a perfect example of when I met Amy later on at a party, because we have a mutual friend, she said she got dropped by about three agents. She got fired from about three pilots. She was at a point in her life where she thought, this isn't happening for me. Mm-hmm. And then she got Junebug. And then she got an Oscar nom.
Yeah.
That was it.
No, and if she had been on Gross Point, she wouldn't have been in Junebug. She wouldn't have got an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
No, but I'm just saying, the universe is complicated. I trace back to like decisions that I've made. I made this very flip decision to go to NYU. I was going to go to all these other schools, and then in the last minute, I applied to NYU, but it changed my whole life. And it was an impulse to go there.
Where did you grow up?
In LA.
Oh, okay. That's right. You grew up in LA. And like what, so did you always want to do film? Did you always want to direct and act and write or what? Does that?
No, I really didn't. I wanted to be an architect when I was young. My father was an agent when I was young, a movie agent, a TV agent, and he represented directors actually. So I kind of grew up around it. And my mother was a food stylist. She did commercials and she would do television shows where people were cooking. And I went to a school where like, you know, my best friend's dad was on Adam 12. I mean, we didn't have a lot of money, but it was just like normal. If you lived in the Valley, people were in the TV business. It's just normal. But so it didn't have any kind of razzle dazzle allure to me, but I knew I wanted to do something creative. And I kept kind of eliminating things. And then I realized in the end, like, because I do like writing and I like design and I like, I was studying art, I like painting, and
you have an amazing eye for design.
But if you're directing, you get to do all of those things. You get to be an architect. You get to be a playwright. You get to be, you know.
That's so true. I never thought of it like that. A director gets to be an architect and help with the sets. I never thought of it like that.
Yeah. So it's good.
So what happened? You just last minute said, why don't I just try for NYU? Like, had you even been to New York?
I'd been to New York once, but I had family in Brooklyn and in Bay Ridge.
Oh, my favorite place. That's where I went to high school.
It is. Because you're from Brooklyn, but not Bay Ridge. You're from...
No, I'm from Flatbush, but I went to Poly Prep in Bay Ridge.
But I realized I was going to maybe go to USC. I got into USC. I got into all these schools because I was a pretty good student. So I had a lot of options. And then I hadn't even applied to NYU. And NYU wasn't a big, fancy school at that point. It wasn't a school everybody was clamoring to go to.
Did you go to the Art Tisch or did you?
Yeah, to Tisch. Okay. And not even a friend, just somebody that I knew in high school. He said, I'm going to NYU. And I said, that's fun. I think I want to go there. I want to live in Manhattan and go to school. So I applied late and got in, and everybody was trying to talk me out of it because there were, I don't know, more.
Well, it's across the
academic
country.
Schools,
it's,
huh?
It's across the country. So it's got to be for any parent a little bit daunting. I mean, it's literally.
No, and I realized I wanted to get away from my parents and my family, and I wanted to sort of jettison my personality in high school and create a new persona in the village in the 80s. It was great.
That was your first, can we call that your first act?
It was the first. Well, yeah, there are a lot of second acts, but yeah, that was, I got my senior year in high school, I had braces for 4 years and I had just the worst hair, but I got my braces off and I got a good haircut and I left all of my clothes from high school and I went to NYU and like went to Canal Jean and bought some vintage, you know, shirts. And I was like, this is me now. This is me.
Same. That's what I did. So that was your first act. Let's say you move, you change your whole persona. Like me, get away from everybody, the family, start over. I even changed my name. I was like, I'm not Bonnie Jean. I'm not BJ. I'm Bonnie. Like I like was like new persona, totally new Bonnie. So you go to NYU and you're like, what happens? You love it?
I freaked out because the city was so claustrophobic when I got there. But after 2 weeks, I got over it. I really thought, I can't live here. I'm used to hillsides and trees and space. And I was living in this tiny little dorm room with cinder block walls that faced a brick wall. You know, it was really close quarters with this roommate, the guy who from my high school, we ended up being roommates.
Oh, that's good though.
Crazily enough. But and I did well there, but I sort of settled in and I did well. And I became a sort of maniac about wanting to make as many movies as possible and be the best, because I've made movies since I was a little kid, just as for fun, little Super 8 movies. And I'd done a 30-minute movie in high school. I went to the school where if you finished all of your academic requirements, you could do a senior project and just make something. So I'd made this movie, and I'd been on...
A little movie, was it Star Wars?
No, it was just this terrible little black and it was like a black and white period piece. But anyway,
a black and white period piece.
Yes, no, but it was set in the Valley in the 50s. And the Valley still looked like the 50s then, so it wasn't that.
Yeah, it still does now.
Elaborate, yeah. But I became a maniac at NYU about wanting to do this thing. And I made a lot of films and I was very aggressive. A very type
A. Did you write
A.
them all too? You wrote all the...
Yeah, wrote them all and directed them and and like won a couple of awards. And one film, which was... I'd actually studied animation at first. It was a mixture of animation and live action. And it was only about 4 minutes long, but it turned out really, really, really well. And it won a lot of awards and it played at the Museum of Modern Art. And this company asked to distribute it and it played on HBO. Mm-hmm. Remember when HBO was young? Well, you're probably too young. They would play films.
Bless you.
Little short films.
Yeah. Remember when Cinemax was porn?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not that young. So you got on HBO. Your film got on HBO and you're in college.
But I got an agent while I was still in school. And I was just like, manic. And then some friends and I started writing a feature script. We just outlined it. And then we graduated. And then I wrote it. And I had gotten an agent from this short film. And I gave it to him and he gave it to a producer. This is like a year after I graduated. I wrote a draft of it myself. And I had this one meeting with this woman, Gail Ann Hurd, who had just produced Aliens and before that Terminator. It was literally my first meeting out of school.
Okay, this doesn't happen, guys.
No, I know, it's crazy, it's crazy.
This doesn't happen to everybody.
My mother drove me to the meeting. It was at 20th Century Fox. And she said, I'll be right here, dear. Like she knitted, like she literally, had, you know, a sandwich while I'm in with this meeting.
And what was the script called?
It was called Bad Dreams. It was a horror movie about like a hippie cult that sort of did a mass suicide. And then one girl survives and she's sort of Rip Van Winkle. And she wakes up in the 80s and she's all out of place. It was crazy and very violent. And you know, I don't know. But anyway, she said yes, they optioned it. And then a year later, I was directing. I was 24 years old. And I was directing a movie at Fox. No, but I'm only telling you this, it sounds crazy and like, how dare you be so successful so soon? But I made the movie. It turned out okay. It was not a critical hit, but it made a little bit of money. But Hollywood just didn't care. And then there was a writer's strike. And then I realized that I really hadn't made that much money doing it because they just paid me scale. Uh-huh. And I like... everything just nosedived and I got very depressed and I didn't work for years, like 3 years. I didn't do anything. I kind of slept on my sister's couch. I ran out of money. And I thought, well, I've directed a movie. I thought everything would be golden and everything just kind of fell apart.
That's exactly, I love that you just told that story. Cause that's partly why I started this podcast. And in the intro is, everything was going great right up until the moment it wasn't. And my entire life, just everything just at once bottomed out. And for me, from 24, from when I got Gross Point, there was a period of time where I couldn't not get a job or a development deal. I literally would do absolutely nothing, just be myself and get a sitcom and, you know, and just my personality. But it wasn't acting to me. It was just me being me and saying lines. And then all of a sudden I got this, you know, Code Black medical drama. I got let go. My relationship, I mean, it was the same. And for about 2 or 3 years, I just hit such a depression so late because I was so ridiculous. Yeah. Like I was the girl that everyone was like, oh, Bonnie, she always works.
Yeah.
So you're on your sister's couch and that's another act right there.
And then my brother's couch, you know, and then I just started writing with a friend, just stuff that would amuse us, came up with ideas and bounced things around, tried to pitch things and slowly kind of put it back together.
Were you still depressed at this time, you think? Was this still?
I was kind of snapping out of it. It was more just a shock because I know I just had a lot of friends and I'd made all these friends on the movie. And then when the movie was over, everybody went away because it felt like this family and it felt like such abandonment.
Everybody should know that listens to this, that you hear this, but all of us in the film and TV industry, we become, it's so cliche, but you become a family.
Yeah.
You think you're best friends for life. You're together 16 hours a day. And I have had so many experiences where people have just ghosted and disappeared. And I've been heartbroken thinking like, but we're going to work together forever though. Like you're going to hire me for, like, we're going to be best friends.
Yeah.
And then it's hard. I don't know if you've had, I've had drops after jobs end, like depression, you know, drops.
Yeah, for sure. But I realized, oh, there's probably no way around it because it's such a high to make a movie, especially for the director, because it's like boom, 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 boom. You have to make decisions, decisions. And then when it's over, the house is very quiet. And I thought, you know what? It's going to always be like this. It's always going to be like full on, full on, full on, and then nothing.
And then when you're not working, all of a sudden nobody calls anymore. Nobody asks you anywhere.
It's like you lost all your friends. But I was lucky because I was a director, but I was also a writer. I'd written that script to begin with. So I could say, well, I'll just go write something else. So I tried writing things and nothing really kind of coalesced. I optioned one script with a friend. We sold just an idea and we're working on that. But I started taking, a friend of mine was in an acting class and I thought, you know, it would be good to have some kind of structure. I never really learned how to talk to actors. So I went to this acting class. They were teaching the Meisner technique.
That's woman, what I did.
Joanne Barron. Oh, really? Mm-hmm. And I audited one class and they said, this is stupid. I should just do it. It's silly for me to just watch. So I did it, not thinking I would be an actor, and I got into it and kind of stopped working. So I did that for 2 years. I didn't actually write. I was just going to class because it was very time consuming. It was 3 days a week plus rehearsals.
And how were you living financially at the time?
I had optioned this one script and I got this big fat residuals check at one point.
Listen, that's the only reason why I'm still surviving.
No, it was shocking to me. I was sleeping on my sister's couch and I got a residuals check for, I'll just say it, for $35,000.
What?
Yes. And I was like, I could live off of this back for in like those 2 days, years.
Yeah, they were bigger checks back then. And I remember my Garden State soundtrack that I had the song on, that residual check, because that did so well. I mean, I like lived for a year. I mean, same thing. It was like,
because I was broke. Yeah. I was broke sleeping on my sister's couch, and I got this check. And so I got an apartment and I just started going to this class full time. But something happened in this class. We do these exercises and you do presets and set up a relationship. So there's this relationship where this woman in this class, she was always flirting with me, and she knew I was gay, but she likes to flirt with me. So
we all do, Andy.
It embarrasses me.
I know, but if I say this now, look, you can't see him, but he's blushing, and he'll just change the subject immediately.
People love embarrassing me like that. But it's a thing. But anyway, she more than anybody else. So we did this exercise, and it was about a woman who was like really crushing on a guy, but he's gay, and they, you know, she knows, but she can't stop herself. And I was like, I remember this relationship, because this is sort of like something that happened in college. This is a very complicated relationship with a woman. And it just exploded, and I had this idea to write the script, which became Threesome, about three people in college.
That's what I was going to say. That was my first. First knowing of you before I knew you was the movie Threesome.
I wrote it in like a week, and it was this fever pitch. And I wanted to write the script that you could read really easily, that didn't have a lot of description, that was just like line, 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 one description, line, line, line. So it was like, it became like crack, like what's going to happen? Are they all going to sleep together? And you know, who's in love with who? And you know, and I wanted it to be small. And
how did you write that in a week? Like if you were just going to tell a young writer, like what was your process? Was it just that you were just on such a high?
I went into like a fever dream. And I actually found the document that I wrote. I wrote this like five page document that was just like, this is happening, then this is happening, then this is happening, then this is happening. And then I just turned it around and wrote it. I think I wrote the script in like 48 hours.
Babe, are you paying attention? Because we're working on writing a pilot, and Dave wants to write it. And I see he's very quiet. His eyes are open. He's listening to every word. So you did it the unconventional way. Because that's also one of the reasons I love about you, is you don't follow all the stupid Hollywood rules, like how to write a script and how to be this, how to be this. You're very, very much your own person.
Yeah, no, I mean, I take a screenwriting class at NYU, and the guy was very nice, but I felt like I knew more about screenwriting than he did. I was a horrible student at NYU. The teachers all resented me, except a few who took me under their wing. But
I like that you wrote it like that. It's almost like a play. It's almost like you wrote like line, 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 line.
And
line.
I've not done that since then. I've written other things and had really elaborate description, and it's, you know, I every script gets written in a different way.
How did you cast that? Because it was Laura Flynn Boyle.
Well, the thing is that people read it, and people were like, did you read this? And it kind of became a thing, mm-hmm. because it was very kinky. And also the lead character was gay. There was no movie like that in 1993, which is about what it was. There were just no movies about gay people, except, you know, sad AIDS little indie movies like that. And this was kind of post AIDS.
Very kinky.
It was very foul mouthed, and it was very autobiographical. I mean, there are scenes in that movie that are just lifted from reality. So people saw that, but anyway, it got made, and then it went to Sundance, and it turned everything around.
That's what I was going to ask you, because I remember Threesome just as a viewer, and then I remember you talking about it with Lindsay and I when we worked together, and that movie, when it went to the festivals in Sundance, was that like a big, that was it? Like everything just went boom.
Yeah, but it was also, I had to kind of come out to do it. I mean, I didn't really come out. I just sent that script out, and people just assumed I was gay because the character was like me, and that kind of telling that secret and telling those stories was like, oh, I have to use myself. It was the first time I'd written something where I was using myself rather than creating something or filching ideas from other people. I just said, this is going to be totally something that I know has happened, or stories that have happened to me, or that I know have happened to other people. And that's, I've realized that's what you have to do. You have to use your life.
Is that what they say, write what you know? Is that?
Yeah, but it's use your life. You know, you tell the truth.
How does that work when you're, I mean, I'm jumping ahead because now we'll go back, because you've done so much directing and television. Do you use that when you're directing something like that's completely like Emily in Paris, which, by the way, congratulations, Golden Globe nomination.
Thank you.
You're so fancy and you're doing my little podcast, but does that work in anything you do? You just find a way to make it yourself?
For example, the next thing I did after Threesome was The Craft. And at first I was just going to rewrite it. I was going to do a draft and not direct it. But I took these four characters, about four girls who are dabbling in witchcraft.
Oh, yes. I've seen about 20 years.
And I decided to personalize them. Like, I decided to take something from my high school experience where I witnessed like really horrible bigotry and bring that into one story. I remember there was a girl at NYU and she had burn scars all over her body. So she wore a lot of clothes, but you never saw them. And I thought that was more disturbing to not see what it was. Mm. And I brought that in. And the suicidal thing was, I suppose, pulling from my depression. And so I just kept pulling things from my life into it, like tried to personalize the movie. Even though it's about four girls, it was easy for me to, as a gay man, kind of put myself in the headspace.
In a marginalized, you know.
Yeah, being marginalized. Being
marginalized way of life as a gay man. Yeah, as women. That's, I think, also, I always say women and gay, why we love our gays, you know, our men so much. You know, it's just like.
But the idea of. Yeah, of the other. And but so it was that, a matter of personalizing. And
that's interesting. And can you do that now? Like, if you're directing this huge, glamorous, beautiful show in Paris, do you still personalize it?
Totally. Because, you know, I didn't write Emily in Paris, but I was there while Darren was developing it. And he certainly bounced ideas off of me. But I'm Emily in Paris. I mean, literally... The show is very pretty. It's the prettiest,
it's stunning
postcard version of Paris. And most Parisian television shows and movies that are contemporary show a kind of grittier version where you see graffiti and you see the garbage on the streets and you see nefarious activities. But for us as Americans, for me, when I go to Paris, I don't see that. I don't want to look at the graffiti. Look at that beautiful view there. Look at that cute little cafe. Like, that's
that bridge. Yeah.
So, for sure. And, you know, every encounter she had with a brusque Parisian is something that I've lived through. I mean, I've been to Paris so many times before we did the show, and it's always given me a sense of anxiety. Even though I think it's beautiful, I feel like an outsider here.
Thank you.
And I thought it would be great to go there and kind of get past that and sort of ease into it. And I think that's going to be Emily's arc, is that she feels so much like an outsider, but that eventually she's going to learn a little bit of the language and she's going to know the streets and where to turn and where to go. And you know what I mean? She's going
to
become.
That is funny. That's like a metaphor. I feel like that sounds so similar to, I still feel like an outsider still after doing this for so long sometimes, you know what I mean? Like, just uncomfortable, you know, in certain situations. And I'm still the girl from Brooklyn. I'm still the girl that doesn't belong here. I'm still the girl that didn't do the normal thing and get married and have kids and is kind of loud and inappropriate. That's like so similar to that feeling of fish out of water. And people are like, how are you ever insecure? Like, you just hide it.
No, I am too. I did not have the personality to be a director. I was felt like I'm the weirdest person. Why? I'm not that guy. I'm not I'm the take charge guy. And I have had to create that personality. I've had to put
You also were working with you. I love that you said you took an acting class, because you're one of those directors that I've worked with that you are so, it's funny that you say you didn't know how to talk to actors. You're the best with the actors. Like, you are so.
Well, that class helped. But before that, when I had just gone to film school and I had acted a little as a kid and I was into kind of theater things and acted in other students' films. So it wasn't foreign to me, but I felt like I didn't have a language. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know how it's working. Like, actors just come in and do it well, and it's magic. And I was, how do you do that? It was nice to have this technique and go like, oh, if you do this work, you'll be this good. You may not be brilliant, but yes, preparation. And even if you're talented, you have to prepare, you know?
Yeah. And you have to stay that way too. Cause I think part of why I kind of took a nosedive is getting a little lazy, getting a little bitter that I didn't get the jobs I thought I would have and comparing myself to other people. I stopped doing all that preparation, all that excitement, all that gratitude, and it affected my career.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to say like that I'm not having the career other people have. I decided on my first movie, it was produced by Gail Anhurt, and she was married to Jim Cameron at the time. And he was around a lot. And he was very nice to me. He was one of the few people that actually acted as kind of a mentor to me, because it doesn't happen very often, that kind of thing in Hollywood. But I kept comparing myself to him. And I was like, and it was, which is so stupid, because he was kind of the hottest director in Hollywood at that point. And I just said, I'm not Jim Cameron. I'm not Jim Cameron. I can't do what he does. I'm not going to do what he does. I'm going to do me. And it was like, I had to stop comparing myself to other people.
I'm still trying to learn that. I'm better. But you know, actresses, we have a different, there's a whole different ball game when, as far as, especially getting older, being a woman.
I think it's true. Well, you look like a 12-year-old.
Thank you. Important. I'm like dripping in afterbirth right now.
What was I going to say? The thing is, oh, just about why somebody gets a part. The people who are not good don't get the first callback. But if you're in that group of people who are considered good actors and you get the callback, whoever gets that, it's rarely who's the best. It's more what your energy is. It comes in and it coalesces with this part, because the end result is the part plus the actor equals
the energy. And I that's how I feel about you. I love your energy so much, and you appreciate mine, which is not the easiest, and not everyone does, but that's okay. But I find in this COVID world, I just booked my first job off of self-tape, first time in 25 years. I have never booked a job off of self-tape, because I am the type of girl that I'm good in the room. I need the room. I feed off the energy. I like to, and know, other actors, they hate the room.
You just have to make this a room. I know, because I sold a pitch during the pandemic and made, you know, a couple of other deals, but over Zoom, but it worked.
This isn't over Zoom. This is like when you're in your house and my fiance is taping me. It's like, I find what you just said about energy, I feed off of that so much, you know? So the auditions are so different, but I did book a job off of self-tape, so
yeah. That's great.
So after Threesome, so that kind of was huge. I mean, I remember it. I saw it in New York City. And then what happens after that? So you write The Craft.
So I wrote The Craft. And
that was huge.
The phone's submarine. Yeah, I wrote The Craft, and I wasn't going to direct it. But as I was writing it, I said, you know what? I think I want to direct this. And it was a hit. It was like number one at the box office. Mm-hmm.
Of the first movies with four young girls as leads.
Yeah, and it was the studio was very reluctant to do a teenage movie, because teenage movies were not a thing at that point. This was before Scream, it was before Buffy or anything.
Little did they know.
Yeah, and also just a horror movie that has girls in the lead. Will guys come see it? They were so down on this idea.
What made you decide to direct it? What changed your mind?
I just spent time. It cast a spell on me. No, shitty line I've said.
That was a good pun. Okay.
It's terrible. I just spent time with those characters and I thought, oh, I could do this. And I didn't want to do a horror movie. That's why I said I didn't want to direct it. I didn't want to do another horror movie because it's you know, weird. It's dark. It's a dark place to be. You come home covered in blood and, you know, but this felt different. It didn't feel like a generic horror movie where there's just a guy killing people. It felt like it also wasn't really a horror movie in the conventional sense, because it's kind of fun. It's kind of wish fulfillment. And there's no monster. So anyway, I did that and it did well. And I had this sort of golden ticket to like, what's the next movie you want to do? And I wanted to do this movie that I had developed with my friend Cheryl Longin, which was Dick, which is a parody of the Watergate scandal about how teenage girls are deep throat. It was Kirsten Dunst and Michelle Williams when they were babies.
Babies in it. It's one of my favorite movies. If you guys haven't seen it, you need to see it.
They're so funny in the movie. And it's like, it was really fun. And it was interesting because The Craft was a very difficult movie to make. And people were kind of sniping at my heels the whole time.
Why was it difficult?
Partially it was just that the studio didn't seem to know what it was. And we kept having to kind of fight for the vibe.
Was that different also because Threesome was more indie and then you went to a big studio movie? Is that because I didn't know
For sure. That was the first time I was doing a full on studio movie, and which just means there's a lot more people, there's a lot more supervision. It's just difficult. And it was also every single week we started at 5 a.m. and then we would go to nights. So it was exhausting. It was literally super, super exhausting. And it was hard for the four actresses because they were young and they were suddenly. They were carrying the movie. They were always sort of like one, and suddenly there was a lot of pressure on them. But when we finally did a preview and it did really, really well, and the studio saw it and they're like, oh, okay, everything changed. Everybody's like, we love this movie.
That's always the way. You have a million. It's
brilliant.
And then they're like, you're brilliant. You're amazing. You could do whatever you want.
But
did you have Dick in your mind before? You wrote that, or did that just
stick in my mind? Period. Yes.
Yeah. I knew where I was going with that one.
It's the joke that keeps on giving.
I too have Dick on my mind, by the way. Yes.
I wrote it after The Craft. I wrote it with Cheryl.
Was it something you had like churning around for a while?
It came out. Well, unlike Threesome, it took years for it to kind of come together. Actually, those two characters, the two teenage girls, migrated from two other stories. We kept stories about like families, the divorce and the 70s, and it kept morphing and changing. We kept optioning out different versions of the story. And then finally, those two characters, we were trying to make a series about these two teenage girls, and it was set in the 70s. And one of the episodes was they stumble into the Watergate burglary and they become deep throat. Ha ha ha, that's so funny. And then we're like, wait, that's a whole movie. You have characters sometimes and they're floating around saying things and then you have to find a story for them.
Wow. Do you always have multiple film and show ideas in your head at the same time? Like always floating around?
You kind of have to keep a lot of balls in the air. Otherwise.
Ba-dum-bum.
Yeah. No, I will say that the pandemic, I realized, we're going to be shut down here. I should start reading books and look at things and develop things and use it as a moment to.
When you're working on something though, do you focus only on that one thing, or is because you're such a creative? Like, is your brain always going? Like, it's hard, whatever I'm doing, I'm thinking of something else. That's just me.
If you're directing, you kind of just have to pay attention to that because it's so exhausting. You don't really have energy to go write something after
work. And Dick was a big hit.
Huh?
Dick was a big hit.
No, it wasn't a hit. It was a real flop financially, but it was one of the better reviewed movies that year. And people in the comedy world said, this is bananas. It had Will Ferrell in it and it had, Dave Foley and it had, all these cool people, all these cool comedy people in it. So I suddenly had like a lot of comedy cred. And in fact, that's when Darren saw it and I had a meeting with him and that's how I got involved with Gross Point. He liked.
That's Darren Star we're talking about.
Darren Star.
Great Darren Star.
So, and then we had a meeting and he's like, he showed me the script. And I was like, yeah, that was the first pilot I'd ever done. I'd only done
four. Wait, Gross Point was your first pilot too?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Look, I feel even more special. All right, we're going to take a quick break, okay? Take a quick break, and we're going to be right back with the fabulous Andy Glenn. I want to talk for a quick sec about our newest sponsor, eBay. You guys know you can get practically anything on eBay, but did you know it's basically the original sneaker marketplace? you can find the exact shoe you're looking for. And with eBay's authenticity guarantee, you know you're getting shoes that have been meticulously inspected by independent professional authenticators. They verify the box, logo, stitching, and tons of other inspection points. Each sneaker comes with an authenticity guarantee tag and a digital stamp of authenticity. And you sneaker sellers, you guys are protected with a verified return process. And right now they've eliminated selling fees on shoes over $100, making it free to sell or flip your collection. And by the way, I'm a women's size 9. If you want to send me some, my birthday's coming up in 2 weeks. Just saying. Go to ebay.com/sneakers today. eBay, the world's best destination for discovering great value and unique selection. All right, we're back with my friend, the Renaissance man, Andy Fleming. I also say that because I don't know if people don't know this about you. And I think it's so amazing that you do this fabulous, quote, fabulous for a living job. And you are the most at home on a ranch with your doggies in your cowboy boots and having a nice little whiskey or a margarita. And like, it's so awesome. Talk about anti-Hollywood.
No, it was a conscious decision just because I'd grown up around the business and I, you know, was kind of thrown headlong into it when on my first couple of movies. And people would say, well, you should come to a party. So-and-so is going to be there. You have to talk to them about this and you should become friends with so-and-so and so-and-so. And I would get party anxiety and I would go to parties and say hello to the host. And then I would go into the bathroom and sit there and then I would just quietly leave. I mean, I'm okay now. I like parties now, but well, now there aren't any parties, but yeah. I can't live in Hollywood and do that. So I saved up my pennies and bought a horse ranch. And that's what I would do on the weekends. I would go ride horses and I would go show and just, it's like cowboy. It's not fancy English. It's
it's real cowboy.
It was a way of, it was my way of de-stressing. You can't, if you're stressed and you get on a horse, you have to let go of all of it because the horse knows if you're preoccupied or nervous. So you have to just completely let go of it.
And how many horses do you have?
I really only have one that I ride now, but it's a horse ranch. It's a facility. There's 30 horses.
It's amazing. It's so beautiful. I still remember that weekend. Can I get an invite on the air?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
We've all heard that.
You'll have to come back.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, so was Dick, because The Craft was such a success box office and Dick wasn't, but I just remember it was, but maybe that's just because I liked it. But was it hard for you to go from that financial hit to a flop, or was that like hard?
It was really hard. It was really disappointing when there was a really bad preview for Dick, but it was because the audience was not really recruited properly. And the theater was half empty and it got this really, and I've always gotten really good preview numbers, which is these test screenings that you have to do for movies. And so that was awful. But then the head of the studio, this guy, Mike Medavoy, he was so great. He said, you know what? There's nothing wrong with this movie. We just need to just preview it again
in a
better theater and get the right audience in there. And then we had it and we had a perfectly fine preview, like a good preview, like an 80%. But that guy was super cool about it. But I could tell that this was not going to be a huge financial success. But I remember when it came out, there were so many good reviews. I was like, it doesn't matter. And I loved the movie. I'm still shocked that I was able to make this bonkers movie and call it Dick. And because it exists in its own like weird little universe, but people really loved it. And you know, I also people like kind of looked at it as like you did a horror movie about witchcraft and then this, and people were like,
yeah. How does that work? Like, how do you
who the hell are you?
Was it hard for you or did you ever get any, cause I'm asking as an actress, cause I've gotten pushback from trying to play different things. You just kind of did your own thing. Do you think that's also cause you write them? So you can do whatever the fuck you want.
I can sort of create the space I'm going to. Wow. But I just feel like after having done a horror movie, the last thing in the world I want to do is a horror movie. And I also know that in The Craft, there's this one scene where Fairuza Balk's character, Nancy, kind of wishes her evil stepdad to death. And he's been sort of physically abusive and he's a horrible person and he dies. And so they're grieving. And then an insurance guy comes by and says, you know, by the way, you have $200,000. And they're like, yay, $200,000. Oh, what a sweet guy. You know, it was a comedy scene in a horror movie. And I really thought that was my favorite scene. And I was like, well, that means I'm not a horror movie director. I should just be doing funny
comedies.
Stuff.
So yeah. Gross Point, again, that was your first, I can't believe I didn't know that was your first pilot. So that's began your long relationship with Darren Star and my long, because I always say to people, Darren Star gave me the lead in three shows. Gross Point, Kitchen Confidential with Bradley Cooper, who ended up, you know, his
whatever career happened to him?
His career went in the toilet. I don't know. I thought he had a shot. Yeah, I thought he was talented. And Cashmere Mafia. And I remember, like, you know, you hear about, oh, this person's a muse and they work with this director all the time. And since then, he hasn't hired me, which is fine. No, for whatever reason. But I always say, like, on Cashmere Mafia, I said to him on set, I go, well, Darren, I mean, third one's the charm, right? Like, this is it. And then he's like, either that or we'll never work together again. And he made a joke.
He didn't say that.
But
did he?
Yeah, kind of in his sweet way. I'm doing it my way. But he gave me, I mean, again, like so many chances. And it's just the luck of the draw that none of them took off. But Gross Point
very
really
low. Gross Point lives on, I believe.
It really does. And it is so true about the business. If people want to watch a show that, even though it's dated, it's older, it still holds true. Like I watched
a couple of episodes recently because I've been working with Robin Schiff, who ran the writer's room on that show. And it was hilarious. And it's also, the fashions are great because it's like late 90s, early aughts. And it's so
much fluorescent.
Sort of pops. Yeah. It's so teen fluorescent. It's amazing.
So after the dick and after Gross Point, so then you started working in TV all the time. You did four episodes.
Skip ahead. I did a lot of movies in a row after that. And everything was just like, okay, another movie, another movie, another movie, a pilot, another movie, another pilot. And then there was this point where I had done Hamlet 2. And then I did this little movie, Barefoot, with Evan Rachel Wood and Scott Speedman. And nobody saw this movie. And I kind of... I just hit a wall, you know. It was like nothing was coming together, and I was like, it was another lull. It was like what had happened to me when I was 23, but it was kind of worse because it coincided with the financial collapse of the bank, and I just realized, can I do this anymore? Like, am I relevant? It was the older, middle-aged version of that, and more complicated, and a long relationship fell apart in the middle of that, and you know, I sold my house in LA. It was just like a real big come down, and I remember doing an episode of this TV show. It was the only really bad experience I've had in TV, and it was really miserable time. And this one,
who was it? Tell me right now.
No, I mean, I can't. Okay. This one producer was very, very nasty to me, I think, because I honestly thought of quitting. I called my agent and said, can I just walk off this show? And he said, well, you'll kind of end your career forever if you do. So I didn't. But I thought of just, you know, selling everything and opening a landscape business or something. I don't know. Just, I really wanted to get out of it. And
that's, I so relate, Andy. That's exactly how, where I was at. I was like, I'm quitting. I said, I'm not relevant. I didn't make it where I thought. I'm not the ingenue. I'm not the pretty girl anymore. Like, I'm old. And my mother, God bless her, was like, are you fucking out of your mind? You're not quitting. I was like,
what else are you gonna do?
No relationship.
What else are you gonna do?
Seriously, you have no college degree. You don't know anything. I mean, what are you gonna do? But I was like, this is it. I think I've reached it. And you just get that feeling, just that feeling so many people can relate to, of like, oh shit, like what am I gonna do?
Yeah, and it becomes so fulfilling because you start sending out. It's like that thing where somebody's broken up with you. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to date you. You know what I mean? And if you've not gotten a couple of jobs, you start to stink, and you carry that stench
yes,
when you come into the room.
Yes. Oh my God. I was just saying that. I was telling Dave when we first met, I was saying that because I was depressed and I was so angry and so bitter and same thing, relationship didn't work out and baby and marriage, all of it. I would walk into the room with this, that's the perfect way of putting it, the stench of just bitter and bitchy and like, yeah, whatever, you know who I am, but you're going to make me read fine. Blah, 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 blah. And I was self like, and then I finally was like, wait a second. Like you got to take a minute here and like regroup because they could smell it. They could smell it.
Yeah. Bring your joy.
I had to find my joy again. That's right. How did you find your joy?
And
again?
What excites you? Well, I really didn't know what to do. And also the movie business was changing so drastically. It used to be that you kind of go get money and you put a movie together and then you'd find distribution and you'd go to Sundance and it was all, but fewer and fewer people were going to the movies.
Right.
And more people were, so I was wanting to do TV, but more TV, but I wasn't on anybody's list. And then just sort of out of nowhere, Will Gluck, who was on Gross Point, mm-hmm. called me and said, would you come direct an episode of the show he was starting, the Michael J. Fox show? And I was like, sure, so go to New York. I'll direct a half hour of Michael J. Fox. And it was a really lovely experience. And Michael, it was like a bottle episode, which was, you know, no guest stars, no fancy locations. It was a half a day out. And everybody's saying, this is kind of a turd of a script. I was like, it is? I think it's all right. But anyway, I turned it in and the show hadn't started airing yet, and this was episode 8 or 9.
What show was this? Was this
it was called the Michael J. Fox Show. Oh, and it only lasted one season and it had a great cast. But I don't know, people were just not ready for it. But before it even aired, I turned my cut in and the producer's like, this is really good. Why is this so good? And I had cut it right to time. You know, so it was tight and everything worked. And then they gave it to the network or they gave it to the studios. You're like, this is really great. And they gave it without doing any modifications. And they gave it to the network. And this is great. This needs to air second after the pilot. So like, why is this episode so perfect? And they immediately booked me for 3 more episodes. And became this wonderful experience where I didn't do that many episodes of Gross Point. I think I only did 3.
Or I think four. You did 4.
I think I did 4, but NBC was suddenly enamored of me. And then there was this pilot with Kate Walsh and I just was desperate to do it because I thought it was really funny. And Adam McKay and Will Ferrell were producing it. And I just went in there and got that job and then got 3 more pilots in 1 year. I was the guy, like, because I've been sitting at home. And then a year later, I was the guy who had directed 4 pilots in the air, all of which got on the air.
Talk about a second act. Hello.
Crazy.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It was Isn't that bananas. Crazy though?
In the middle of that, I had written this script, which is very, very autobiographical about my relationship and got Steve Coogan and Paul Rudd to agree to play the two leads. And so did that movie, which was a great experience, even though nobody saw the movie. It's called Ideal Home. It's called Ideal Home. Have you ever seen it? You should watch it. It's honestly, it's my favorite movie. It's the favorite thing I've ever done.
Really? Okay, I'm watching it.
It's really funny. They're hilarious, and it's very good, and it's fun to watch. You'll recognize me and things in it. But I always am shilling that movie because nobody saw it. It didn't really even get properly released.
You did. That sounds again, someone you work with and know, like that reminds me of Jason Bateman. Cause you did an Arrested Development, right?
Yes.
Like his story about being absolutely dead, unhirable. His wife, Paul Anka's daughter, has all the money. You know, he's just the dad. He was a kid star. And I mean, literally he is now one of the most beloved and now he's directing Ozark.
Everything gajillion times. Yeah. And so talented. Yeah. He was lovely on Arrested Development. But that guy, Mitch Hurwitz, who created Arrested Development, he just came to me. He'd seen Dick and just said, do an episode, do your thing. He was just, and he's such a great guy. And I've worked with him since then, but it's.
Where in this time period did you do The In-Laws with Lindsay Sloan? Our beloved
that was,
Lindsay Sloan.
right after Dick. Yeah, I did this movie with Michael Douglas and Albert Brooks and Candice Bergen and I don't know if I've ever. I think I've told Lindsay the story, but well, she remembers. It was the part that she played in the movie was the last thing to be cast, and a lot of cool people read for that part, and I really wanted Michael to be a part of Michael Douglas because he was a producer to be part of the process. And Lindsay was in the mix, and I didn't want to like say I want Lindsay, even though the first time I read that script and I knew Albert Brooks was playing this one part, I knew that his daughter had to be Lindsay. I was like, Lindsay is the perfect person to be his daughter. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I'm going to recuse myself from this decision. And so there were three actresses, one of whom is very famous now, one who is sort of not famous, and Lindsay. And I sat with Michael and watched the auditions, and he's like, I like that one. And I was like, okay, good. And he didn't know that she was my friend. So I called Lindsay, and she was fully expecting to not get the part. And I was just,
she always is. She always is.
I know. So I called her. I was like, hi, how are you? I did that thing.
I hate that thing. I
was like, hi. Oh, I'm so fun. And like, we talked for like 5 minutes, and I said, well, and she mentioned something, a date or something. Well, I don't know if you're going to be able to do that because you're going to be in Toronto and Chicago making this movie. She's like, what?
Oh, my God. I hate that, but I love that. I remember my old managers used to do it every time, and they would do it when I didn't get the job. So.
Oh, yeah. You could tell.
Equal parts. Like, they do, oh, hi, you don't get the job. And then, oh, hi, you got it. And you're like, oh, my God. You know.
No, you can tell from
that was one of the best. She had the best experience, like the best time. And she got to work with one of her comedy heroes.
Right. It was the most fun because it was the first time I'd ever done a movie where there was enough money for everything. There's always like, we don't have enough money for that. No, you can't do that. Can't do that. Can't do that. Can't do that. But this was like, it was just fun. And
you had like spy stunts and explosions and yachts. And
yeah, it was very sexy. Built big sets and stunts and visual effects. And yeah, it was so much fun.
So I want to just talk about Emily in Paris. Like when Darren came to you with that, it's so beautifully shot. It's stunning. And it's so you, but were you like, okay, like this is going to be like, yeah, absolutely. Or were you like, well, this is going to be a big undertaking or.
I had heard that he was working on something like that. And I had actually been going to Paris a lot because I was developing something about an American chef in Paris, something that I sold. And then it didn't actually get made. So I had just been in Paris a lot and was just fallen under the spell of it and had been having more fun going there. Cause I used to just go there for work, for meetings and press and things like that. And it always seemed like a big city, kind of oppressive, but this was fun going to restaurants, doing this research. But anyway, Darren gave it to me and we just read it and I gave him my thoughts. I thought it was fun. And I was, but he didn't offer it to me. I think he was going to direct it. And I was just talking about it and he wanted me to come do episodes. And then it became apparent that he was sort of behind schedule on all the scripts. So he decided not to direct. And I said, I'll direct the pilot. And then I just, because I had done it on another show, Insatiable, I became the directing, it's called the directing producer, where I'm there on set every day. And
God, I would love to have you do that.
Supervise other directors so that it all feels like it's one style.
Right. And so you do this and now it's like crazy. I mean, Golden Globe, that's all I ever wanted to be nominated for, really. That's all I care about.
I know it's kind of shocked me. Yeah, and it was also, we were making the show. It's a very little show. It's a half hour and it's very light and fluffy. It's just for fun. It really is. It's a confection. It's like a little slice of cake.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, this is going to find it's a little niche audience and this will be fine. But it was going to be in the Paramount Network and then Netflix bought it, which gave it a larger platform. But then also the pandemic happened and people I just noticed, because I remember when we started it, there's so much darkness on TV. There's so much drama, and there's so many like serial killer things and and like heavy duty social things. And like, where's like the fun TV that I had when I was a kid? It's like bright colors, people laughing, fun stuff.
Yeah, I just saw, I happened to watch one episode of the Drew Barrymore show when I was shooting last week. And she's, you know, Drew, she's just the greatest. I mean, she's the cutest, like, you guys. But one thing she said was, I just miss, like, everything has gotten so heavy. And I just wanted to do a show that was kind of like Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers, old time talk show, fun. And it's kind of true because everything we watch is so, so, I think that's why Bridgerton is such a big hit.
Yeah.
Super over the top costumes, fun, decadent.
But that's always been, I really is my overriding credo is fun. Is it going to be fun to do? And is it going to be fun to watch? Because I, you know, I'm all about dark movies and things like that. I like foreign movies and depressing things, but lately I just want some fun.
God damn it. And also we're dark enough in our heads. I mean,
no, but I thought it's people will appreciate this because it's escapist and fun. And it's not silly. It's not dumb. It's clever.
It is. But, did you think it was going to be so acclaimed, like a hit? Did you know that?
No. It was bizarre the way it happened. First of all, the pandemic, people are either going to say, this is fluffy and I want to have nothing to do with it because it doesn't reflect the world. But what really happened was that everybody wanted like that little trip to Paris. Like everybody wanted to get out of their own headspace and not see masks. And actually the response has been overwhelming. I've had people say to things like Threesome, like I realized I was gay watching your movie, or I came out to my parents after I watched your movie, or people said that about The Craft too. But this was something different. A lot of people contacted me after Emily in Paris and were saying things like, I mean, one friend, she's been going, I didn't know this, she'd been going through breast cancer treatments and she had to be in a hyperbaric chamber for long periods of time. And she said the only thing that made her feel better was watching Emily in Paris. And I was like, oh my God. I mean, somebody whose father had died, like this kind of got her through a week. Like I was like, just because it's so fun, it's so escapist and it's like going to a happy place, because everybody loves Paris and everybody wants to have that beautiful trip there.
Yeah. Yeah. I do too. I mean, it's Paris.
Yeah.
Isn't that the best feeling? I've had that a few times happen to me and I think, oh, nothing I've done is, I've never done my, I haven't had my Meryl Streep moment. I haven't blah, blah, blah. And then someone will come up to me and go, can I just tell you, like, that meant the world to me. And it's the best feeling.
Yeah. It's because it's not why you do it. You do it because you like doing it.
Yeah. But like when people say like that, my song that I wrote, like one guy was suicidal and he learned to play it and people have played it at their weddings and the song that I had on Garden State and they've sent me covers and on YouTube, there's thousands of young girls covering my song and saying, I was so depressed. You know, I have an eating disorder and this just reminds me, I literally have broken down so many times in tears going, that just is everything.
The first time somebody came and said something like that to me was after Threesome. And I'm so leery of Hollywood BS, you know, people like, oh, you're brilliant. You know, I want to work with you, like that kind of stuff. That so compliments seem like they want something from me. And I hold them off because they're not useful creatively. But I was at a party and somebody came up and said something very sincere about how he came out after seeing Threesome. And I kind of made a joke about it and kind of like moved off to get more Chardonnay or something. And my friend said, like, you know, that was really, really rude. And I realized I really have to take that and appreciate it.
I think that's also, as you said, I love you, but you don't like compliments. You do get uncomfortable. You're not really into the compliment thing. Meanwhile, me, I'm like, compliment me more every 2 seconds. But you don't need it. And I think you get really like shy and uncomfortable because it is really a big deal, you know?
It's a big deal for me to go and pay somebody a compliment. But you know what I mean? Like it takes a lot of guts to walk up to somebody and tell them how good something of theirs was. But yeah, I've learned to hear it and appreciate it. No, I just because it is rude to not take that.
It's not rude. I just think I said this also to my fiance because he always blows it off and he's like, no, no, no. He's getting better. But I read this thing on this, you know, this meditation thing I follow. I follow a million of them. But when you compliment someone, when someone really means it and you don't accept it, you're taking away their joy of being able to tell you something that means something to them.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's really, it's the worst.
If you want to compliment me right now, you can go ahead. Shoot.
Your hair is amazing.
I have a good hair day.
Yeah. I know. I like the color.
Thank you. All right. So I'm going to ask you 5 questions right now.
Okay.
You cannot answer them, or you can, but I think you should. And then you could plead the 5th though, if you want to, but that's boring. Because I know you have some good stories and you've told me good stories, but you might not want to tell me on this.
I have a lot of stories.
Oh, I know.
And I have not told them.
One question. I have to ask you this though, because I asked Lindsay. I asked Lindsay the same question when she was on the podcast. If Grosse Pointe was reality, where would our characters be today, me and Lindsay? Courtney?
Well, you'd be friends, right?
I think so.
I know. That's a terrible question.
Not the best question, but we were just wondering where would we be, like, what would we be doing? Marcy would be like, you know, living in her mansion, eating cupcakes.
Marcy would be nailing it. I think your character would be too.
My character would have had a sex tape for sure by now.
What was your character's name?
Courtney.
Courtney, that's right. You know, the person they asked would be Darren. Well, I don't know if you saw the recent reboot of 90210.
Oh, yeah.
It was so bizarre because it was... they were playing themselves. Those actors were playing themselves in reality, not the characters on 90210. But it was scripted, which sounds like a crazy half hour, but it was an hour. There was a lot of things going on in that show. It only lasted the one season, though.
All right, this is a good one for you because you have so many. I actually know a couple, but I don't know if you'll say them. What was the craziest thing that ever happened on a set with actors? I know you have a lot, but like one that stands out, like an actual like crazy actor, like what the fuck?
Misbehavior?
Just anything. Misbehavior.
Misbehavior. I will say there's one actor, and I'm not going to say who it is.
No,
I did a pilot with. It never got aired, and he's famous. He's been the leads of things, and when we were casting him as sort of the heavy in this thing, like the antagonist, and the head of the network says, "Are you sure you want to do that?" And I said, yes. He was like, "You'll be sorry." And he was so awful, this guy. He was so rude and so mean to the crew and mean to me. And I was like, we were warned, but...
Wait, well, what was the most scandalous
thing? What?
On a set.
That he did?
Mm-mm.
Oh.
That you've had on a set, on any of your sets, like scandalous, like...
Well, for whatever reason, actresses that I work with...
What?
They like to embarrass me, so they just do inappropriate sexual things in my general direction to watch me turn bright beet red.
Which you are right now.
Yeah. What was the question?
the most scandalous thing that happened on a set, like
I think. When we were doing Threesome, which is basically every other scene is a sex scene, I think a couple of times something real was happening down there underneath the sheets.
That's what I was hoping and thinking that you would say, because I've always been asked by people like, do you ever really do something? Has a guy ever actually gotten an erection? And I'm always like, no, God, no, not with me. And then I always remember you that there are sometimes where
they were really friendly, Steve and Josh and Laura on that movie. They were really comfortable with each other. They loved hanging out. And when we weren't rolling, they would hang out and laugh and stuff. But I will say that I did the show, this Netflix show called Insatiable. Mm-hmm. And there was a thruple scene in that I had to direct. And
a thruple scene?
a three-way. And so I came in, and I've been on panels about sex scenes in movies, and I'm in a documentary about like sex in cinema just because I made a movie called Threesome. But I was talking about three ways, and I come in just to relax the three actors. It was Alyssa Milano and Chris Gorham and Dallas Roberts, and just telling them about, you know, three ways can go. Three ways are exciting because they can go horribly wrong, or they can just be magical. It's like sex times three. And I started talking about three ways and experiences, and I was like, I have said way too much about three ways at this point. I really need to start talking. And
tell me more. I'm taking notes. Honey, you taking notes? Yeah, we're taking notes. All right. What was the character that you created that you've loved the most? Like your favorite one of all?
Oh, well, it's either the two girls and Dick. But I think it's probably this movie, a new movie, Ideal Home, this character, Erasmus Brumble, that Steve Coogan played. He's this sort of grand, like, English fop. And he just says the most ridiculous things. The character of Erasmus, like, existed before the plot of the movie did.
And was that one of the characters that was bouncing around in your head that you said, I have to find something for him?
Yeah, it was Paul and Erasmus, about this gay couple who are kind of hitting the skids. And originally they were sort of, it was going to be sort of a gay version of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And, but it was, I mean, I was like, I don't want to copy Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but I just loved the two of them because they were just these two middle-aged gay men sniping at each other and drinking and having fights and then laughing. It's that. It's Steve Coogan and Paul Rudd doing that in a movie in Santa Fe.
What do you think is one thing that you have, like an act that you're still not, that you haven't done, that you still want to do? Something that you, that is in you that you want to do, write or direct? Oh. Or is it non-entertainment involved at all?
Well, I've never created a show that's gone to air. I've written a fair number of pilots, and then I've been an executive producer on shows. So that's the next thing I want to do. That's what I'm hoping to do with this one project, and to create a show from scratch.
What do you like better, writing or directing?
They're great yin and yang, because writing, you can sit there and it's quiet and you can have a mineral water in your jammies and be working. But directing is fun because you're out there and you're,
It's chaos
and it's you feeding off of the energy of everybody. So it's like, it's nice to go back and forth. I you know, after having done an entire season of a show, to go to the ranch and just do nothing. I just look at trees for a couple of days.
Take care of yourself well in that way though. Like it's a good way to just decompress and get away from it all.
Yeah. It's nice being in nature.
And all right, you've probably been asked this a million times on all the panels you've done and stuff, but like someone listening to this right now that's like in that dumpy place that we both were in, like what would your advice be if they were a writer or a director and they were in that place of like, I just had a flop, like what am I doing? I can't do this.
Well, first of all, just embrace it. I mean, I have come to embrace like, oh, I'm sort of down. I'm gonna stay in bed. I'm gonna read a book or cook something. You know what I mean? I find that actually cooking something, just putting like chopping up an onion and putting it in a pan. Once you start doing that, you kind of change your brain chemistry and it gets you out of your head cooking. I find it very, very relaxing.
Me too. I love
cooking. Exercise is really important. But I mean, if you're a writer, write. It's that easy. If you're not a writer, like read books, read articles, find out if that could be a movie. Just find a way to get inspired. It's work to be inspired. You know, you'll have to go through a bunch of shitty ideas before you get to one that goes like, wait, this is solid. This holds up. It's airtight.
Yeah.
I write down a lot of ideas and I find that 2 days later, I look at it and go, meh. But if there's one that you just keep going back to,
yeah.
If you get that 2 a.m. factor where, oh, I got to turn the light on and write that down because that's a really good idea.
Mm-hmm. I learned that too, like not fighting the downtime and forgiving myself for it. Like that if I want to stay in bed and like, you know, just being like, you're not a loser. Sometimes you need that. but then just finding any way to be creative anyway helps.
Getting stuff done, just or getting up and it's been such a thing through COVID because you don't really have to be anywhere except maybe a Zoom call.
Are you wearing pants right now on the Zoom call? No, I'm not wearing pants.
Or pants, but
I'm so glad you did this. I thank you so much. You know I love you and adore you. I'm not trying to embarrass you, but you know that.
I know.
I'm very happy about your Golden Globe. I'm so happy. You deserve it. I'm also available to shoot in Paris at any time.
Good to know.
All right.
Noted.
Noted. All right, Andy Fleming.
All right. It's Andrew, actually.
Andrew. Sorry, Andrew Fleming. Where can people find you? Tell them where they can find you. Do you want more social media followers?
Sure. I'm on Instagram, AndyManF, A-N-D-Y-M-A-N-F, like Fleming.
And also, everybody, go and look up some of these movies. Dick is one of my favorite movies. If you young girls today might not have seen The Craft, teenagers today. It was before the whole teenage boom of how I, you know, what you did last summer and all that. And Gross Point is pretty awesome.
Ideal Home, please.
Oh, Ideal Home. Is that the one I should watch?
One person, just go watch that movie. Okay. You'll love it. There's no way to not love it.
Obviously, Emily in Paris, everybody, watch it. And I'm really proud of my friend. And I'm so lucky to know you 20 years.
You really are lucky to know me.
And I can't wait to come to the ranch, baby.
All right, let's do it.
All right, hon.
All right.
Lots of love.
Lots of love. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Dave. Well, that was fun. Only a couple of inappropriate jokes. Had to take the dick joke. Come on. I mean, it's too good. Sorry, mom and future mom-in-law listening to this. he's one of the most humble people I've ever known. And yeah, I love that he doesn't do the Hollywood BS. He lives on a ranch. He's one of the kindest people. And he's not attention seeking at all. And I love that story. See, you know, going to that place where you're just totally depressed and you hit rock bottom and you don't know what you're going to do next. And then you just find it. You just have to keep going. You have to keep going and find whatever it is you love and find your joy. And I love that he was so open about that. And also pretty incredible, like agent selling a script at 24 right out of college. I mean, that definitely doesn't happen every day. But you see, you just got to keep that in your spirit and in your heart and feel the feelings. Like he said, I agree with that. If you're down, walk through it, you know, walk through the fire, feel it. But that was so inspiring. I hope you enjoyed that. God, he's a great guy. Follow him, AndyManF, on Instagram. He has beautiful photos. He's also a great photographer. And yes, watch Emily in Paris. It's a very, very sweet show and it's beautifully shot because he has amazing taste and a great eye. So that's it for this week. Coming at you with way more guests. I'm super excited. Thank you for joining me and following me. Don't forget to download and subscribe. Leave me a great review. It's my birthday soon. So give me a nice birthday present. Leave me a great review. And follow me, second_act podcast. second_act_podcast. I'm going to get this right someday. On Instagram, and me, Bon Somerville, sending you all lots and lots of love. Mwah. See you next time.